the joy of the whole earth, is Mount Zion, on the sides of the north, the city of the great king. God is known in her palaces for a refuge. For lo, the kings were assembled, they passed by together. They saw it, and so they marveled. They were troubled and hasted away. Fear took hold upon them there, and pain as a woman in travail. Thou breakest the ships of Tarshish with the east wind. As we have heard, so have we seen in the city of the Lord of hosts, in the city of our God. God will establish it forever. Selah. We have thought of thy loving kindness, O God, in the midst of thy temple. According to thy name, O God, so is thy praise unto the ends of the earth. Thy right hand is full of righteousness. Let Mount Zion rejoice. Let the daughters of Judah be glad because of thy judgments. Walk about Zion and go round about her. Tell the towers thereof. Mark ye well her bulwarks. Consider her palaces, that ye may tell it to the generations following. For this God is our God forever and ever. He will be our guide even unto death. And now we ask for your attention for our brother John this morning. At this time, we'll ask the young people to dismiss to the front of the hall.
Well, good morning, brethren.
Good morning.
It's truly a pleasure to be here. I feel very blessed to be here amongst our brethren. On behalf of my sister wife and myself, we'd like to extend our gratitude, our thanks, appreciation, and extend the love of the Alamogordo Ecclesia to you all here in Orlando. It's great to be here with you all this weekend. The studies that I've chosen this for our classes are based on Jehoshaphat, as our brother brought out this morning. And I think Jehoshaphat, at first you kind of consider this king as, an important part in the history of Judah, but he is really an enigma when we think about how could such a man of character do some of the things that he did, both good and bad. And that's what we'll talk about today. A little background, we're all familiar with how the nation of Israel, God's chosen people, had been divided. We have Israel in the north, we have Judah in the south, and of course their leaders, their kings that had led them in different directions from that time of division. So division is nothing new. It seems to be something that happens when we get people together, when we have those who begin to be influenced by certain things, whatever they may be. We have strong-willed individuals. Sometimes things begin to happen with groups like this, especially when we're talking about God's people. And we have the result. So we have, as time went on, we have Jehoshaphat. And we're starting here in the 17th chapter. And we're going to go through, as our brother mentioned, we're going to go through the 17, 18, 19, and 20. So all of these are kind of the account of Jehoshaphat and his dealings here with the nation, with Judah. So as we said, one of Judah's first rulers here, no man could educate Judah more than Jehoshaphat did. When we go through this account here, we'll see the effort that he made to educate the ecclesia of God. And that's what we're going to refer to today. When we talk about Israel, God's people, we're referring to them as the ecclesia of God. Because, of course, we know the ecclesia are those called out, those separated, a holy people. In other words, a people for a purpose. And that's what we're talking about. And so this whole, as a whole, we have Israel in the north, Judah in the south. They're all still God's people. But we have Jehoshaphat educating. Okay, so the paradox, though, that we see is that him being this teacher and leader, bringing them to God, it says that he walked in the ways of his father David and sought not unto Balaam. He was this teacher, but he also, we see, made this affinity with Ahab, which we'll get to in the next chapter. So, as we said, it seems confusing to think of someone who was on the right track, who was being led in the right and proper way, had been educated, and was educating the people, and now he comes up with this decision to follow and go along with Ahab. So again, it's a paradox that we see how he not only brought them to one of the greatest heights that they had, that is in Judah, but he also brought them to the brink of ruin, right to the edge. And so, as we said, he becomes an enigma. So, as we go through, then we'll talk about his name. We see how Jehoshaphat, this name, Jehoshaphat, and how this is a combination of these words. Now, we know this is Yah, or Yahweh, hath judged, not necessarily Jehovah, but Yahweh judged. And so, as we go through, we'll see how he makes these decisions, and all of these in regards to God's people. And also, we see how judge here can also be rendered vindicate. So we'll think about this as well when we're talking about the Lord, Yahweh, being vindicated. And so he falls into three distinct phases then when we talk about this life of Jehoshaphat. His life, and work is so important that we should definitely take notice and learn the great lesson from this man. The theme of chapter 17 is the first section that we call Jehoshaphat Goes Up. And he fulfills his name as being Yahweh is vindicated. Yahweh is judge. Divine blessings come upon Jehoshaphat because of a sound policy that he institutes amongst his people. Yahweh blessed him, gave him strength, riches, honor, and abundance, and this was a result of those policies. Then we see the next section would be, tragically, in chapter 18 that we'll talk about, of 2 Chronicles. It sets forth his decline, where the theme of this chapter is Jehoshaphat goes down. Now, when we read those first few verses in that chapter, we see that it's obvious as well that we're talking about a decline in his life from a spiritual point of view. Yahweh's purpose is frustrated, then, we might say, by compromise. Not that it didn't happen as he had planned, but by Jehoshaphat compromising, we see a sad mixture of triumph and tragedy in this life. In this study, we can see how this has brought Judah almost to the point of utter ruin. We can see in this lesson to us the cause for that being this compromise. And hopefully we can learn the same lesson that is set forth for us here. This man's life work was destroyed at one point. His family was ruined, and the promises that God made to David were brought to within a hair's breadth of total collapse because of the change in policy that he started. The theme then of chapters 19 and 20 then describe a man who learns from his mistakes. He turns their hearts back and he sets himself to seek Yahweh once again. And King Jehoshaphat gains the trust and confidence of the people and directs them to be courageous, to rely on the help and the strength of Yahweh, and to give him all the glory and the honor that's due to him. So with words and phrases from the past, Judah is then reminded of the goodness and the severity of Yahweh. They're also reminded of the comfort that they can gain from knowing that their God is the true and powerful God. Now these psalms that we read, our brother read this morning for us, they're Psalm 46, 47, and 48. It's interesting, these are written about the time or during the time of chapter 20 that we'll talk about during this battle, during their triumph, and as they realize that the Lord God in heaven, even Yahweh, was their fighting force who delivered them from this great confederacy of nations. Now, when we talk about that, we can't help but think of the latter day fulfillment of this same thing when we talk about Armageddon. So we'll get into that a little bit as well. But we see how Jehoshaphat exhibits the marks of a man then that has been humbled by providence. He then becomes the epitome of one who understands that our lives should be dependent on the word, the instruction, and the principles of our Father, and never in man. So let's look at the man for a moment. Think about Jehoshaphat as this king. Now, previously, back in 2 Chronicles, back a couple of chapters, we're familiar where we learn more of his father Asa. Some people pronounce it Asa, some people Asa. Anyway, at the age of 10 years old, we see that he was there with his father Asa. And it's interesting, think about being 10 years old, how impressionable we are when we're 10 years old. How much can we understand? How much can we learn? What part of policy do we know when we're 10 years old? Most of those things are beyond us. But we do know of our family, the relationships that we have, the love that we would have for our father and mother. So at the age of 10 years old, we can't fully understand. But Asa, the father of Jehoshaphat, we see in chapter 15, was conducting one of the greatest efforts in the history of Judah. And during this whole time in chapter 15, we see that the young prince Jehoshaphat, being 10 years old, was there along with him. So let's look at chapter 15 just for a moment. We're just going to read verses 8 through 15. And we see what Asa was actually doing. And when Asa heard these words and the prophecy of Obed the prophet, he took courage and put away the abominable idols out of the land of Judah and Benjamin and out of the cities which he had taken from Mount Ephraim and renewed the altar of the Lord and was before the porch of the Lord. And he gathered all Judah and Benjamin and the strangers with them out of Ephraim and Manasseh and out of Simeon. And they fell to him out of Israel in abundance when they saw that the Lord his God was with him. And then in verse 10, and so they gathered themselves together at Jerusalem in the third month, in the 15th year of the reign of Asa. And they offered unto the Lord the same time of the spoil which they had brought, 700 oxen and 7,000 sheep. And they entered into a covenant, to seek the Lord God of their fathers with all their heart and with all their soul, that whosoever would not seek the Lord God of Israel should be put to death, whether small or great, whether man or woman. And so then in verse 14, and they swear unto the Lord with a loud voice and with shouting and with trumpets and with cornets. And all Judah rejoiced at the oath, for they had sworn with all their heart and sought with all their whole desire. And he was found of them, and the Lord gave them rest round about. So again, imagine this that was taking place here in young Jehoshaphat at the side of his father Asa. We see from this particular point onward that Judah never reached a greater height than this. And what was happening here as this 10-year-old boy stood by and observed. He observed this special dedication. He observed the way that this affected the hearts and minds of the people round about him. And seeing how the word of the Lord took hold of them, as we read, and how it drove them to seek Yahweh with all their heart. This word seek will come to several times in this account. So young children such as Jehoshaphat are very impressionable, and this did make an impression on him by the dedication of their parents, their love for the truth. This makes an impression on young ones. And so there's no question that Jehoshaphat was a product of his upbringing. He was a young man that grew up in this environment, in this atmosphere of proper ecclesial life, of positive dedication as he grew up. And so when he came to the age of maturity, he could understand much more, and even the fact that, tragically, his father Asa had begun to set back in his later years and had gone off the rails, so to speak, due to his own self-reliance. And so it seems obvious then that Jehoshaphat became determined not to do the same thing himself as he matured into this young leader of Judah. So this is the account then of chapter 17 of 2 Chronicles. We come to the verse 1, and Jehoshaphat and his son his son, that is Asa's son, reigned in his stead and strengthened himself against Israel. I get to talking and forget to forward my slides here. So, she strengthened himself against Israel. So, we ask ourselves, why would it say that so plainly? Strengthening himself against Israel. It says this because the first verse of the previous chapter, which brought about the demise of Asa, we see Baasha, king of Israel, had come down and was blocking off the border. And he stopped the migration of his subjects into Judah. And Asa couldn't face this. And so he went to Syria and made a covenant or a league with them. And he was rebuked by the prophet Hanani, the prophet, in verses 7 through 9. And he had the prophet thrown into prison in verse 10. And as a result, he became diseased in his feet and again refused to seek the Lord and put his trust in the physicians. This is Asa. And so Asa died from this, having fallen away from Yahweh, God of Israel. Jehoshaphat seemed determined, as we said, not to make this mistake. And so he strengthened himself against Israel. Now, it's interesting to think of this point. We see that the word against, and the word against doesn't always mean against like we think, but this is the Hebrew word al, and it means above or upon and over, from the Hebrew root word Allah or al, Allah, meaning to ascend, to be high. I was thinking of the, isn't it the Israeli Airlines? It's El Al Airlines, I think. And so we see the policy of Jehoshaphat then is set forth. He's determined in his heart to rise above Israel, what they had become. And that's always the way to overcome any problem in life, to rise above it. Sublimation is always better than repression. Jehoshaphat understood the need to rise above Israel and strengthen himself and his people that they might not be troubled by an idolatrous people like Asa had been, and like Israel in the north was headed down a path of destruction because of this. In verse 2 of chapter 17, and he placed forces in all the fenced cities of Judah and set garrisons in the land of Judah and in the cities of Ephraim, which Asa his father had taken. And so from this in verse 3, we see that Yahweh had blessed Jehoshaphat in his policies because he walked in the first ways of his father David. And the margin reads, of his father and of David. And so the first ways of Asa were very good in the sight of Yahweh, and blessed, he was blessed for it as well. But it was later in his years that he fell away. And so Jehoshaphat took up the first ways of Asa and, of course, of David. And then it says, and he sought not unto Balaam. And why would this be brought up? What is this about Balaam? Well, does this ever suggest that Asa sought after Balaam? Well, he didn't, and neither did David. But when Jehoshaphat ascended to the throne of Judah, we see that there was a man on the throne in Israel, and he had been there for 3 years already. A man who by this time had taken a Sidonian for a wife, and was instructing Israel in the vile worship of Baal. And of course, this man we're familiar with is Ahab. Jehoshaphat was well aware of what was taking place in the north. He knew what Ahab was all about, and he knew that Baal worship had become entrenched in Israel. All of this was brought about by the impression of Ahab's wife, Jezebel. They combined together to educate the ecclesia of Israel in the abhorrent practices associated with Baal worship. Remember, these were the chosen people, the seed of Abraham. And here they are, being influenced by Ahab and Jezebel. And so really in verse 3, it's telling us that Jehoshaphat's policy was blessed by Yahweh because he was doing the opposite to what Ahab and Jezebel were doing in Israel, to serve the god of flesh. And so this is plainly spelled out for us in verse 4, where it says, but sought to the Lord God of his fathers, and walked in his commandments and not after the doings of Israel. So we definitely have a separation that's taking place here, an exclusion from those wicked works that were taking place. And so we see that because Jehoshaphat was doing this, because he was rising above, remember he was strengthening himself against. In verse 5, it shows us that Yahweh established his kingdom. Remember, we're told that unless Yahweh builds the house, it will never stand. And so Jehoshaphat was guiding the nation in the way that he thought he must. But it was Yahweh who established it. And this established comes from the word that means to frame it, to perfect it, to make it certain, or to establish it. And so all Judah brought to Jehoshaphat presents, and he had riches and honor and abundance, as we see in verse 5. And the subjects of this nation, it's kind of interesting because normally they're expected to be given something by the rulers. But here at this point, the people of Judah realize the value of Jehoshaphat's leadership. And so they pay their respects to him. And they brought their acknowledgments that they believed that he was leading them in the right and proper way. And so we read in verse 6, "And his heart was lifted up in the ways of the Lord. Moreover, he took away the high places and the groves out of Judah." And so again, we can look at this verse and think of this word lifted up in verse 6. This word gabah, meaning to soar and to be lofty. The idea of flying high. Again, all of this because of the principles and policies that he has established. So here was this man's heart soaring high in the things of the truth, in the ways of Yahweh. He was rising above Israel, and Yahweh was blessing him in this manner, for this particular way. And then it says at the end of verse 6 that he took away the high places and the groves out of Judah. And so he truly loved righteousness, we see, and he hated iniquity. And we get this also from Hebrews 1 verse 9, where it says, "Thou hast loved righteousness and hated iniquity, therefore God, even thy God, hath anointed thee with the oil of gladness above thy fellows." Doesn't this describe Jehoshaphat at this point? And so because his heart soared in the things of the truth, he detested this idolatry that was taking place in the north. And this is the rule of thumb for any true believer, any true Christadelphian, is it not? To hate these things, to turn away from them, to abhor them, to realize where they come from and what it could lead to. It's not a matter of legislation, but it's a matter of having your heart rise to great heights, as Jehoshaphat did, in the things of the truth. We cannot and should not ever tolerate anything that's opposed to the truth. And so here we have in this first verse of chapter 17, plainly set forth a clear direction of policy, and that policy was to strengthen himself against the evils that were taking place in Israel. And so let's pause here for a minute. Again, let's reflect on a very important aspect of this whole scenario one more time. Though Ahab was the worst king in Israel, and his wife was a Sidonian Baal worshiper, Israel still remained part of the ecclesia of God. They were all the seed of Abraham. There was in this nation a covenant family, 7,000 of them who had not bowed the knee to Baal in the days when Elijah had come along. Prophets were sent to them, and among these were Elijah himself, Elisha his successor, and then a man whose name was Micaiah, who we will see in the account that we're studying today. They were sent to upbraid and to warn the rulers in Israel and to try to turn them back, if their heart would be so. And so in the record before us, we're taught that even within the boundaries of Asia itself, apostasy can and had risen. So our lesson, brethren, is that we must be on guard at all times, proving all things and holding fast that which is good in conduct and in doctrine. In the northern kingdom, at the same time that Jehoshaphat was beginning his campaign of education, Ahab and Jezebel were instituting their own campaign, weren't they, of self-indulgence and idolatry. The very opposite of what a chosen people and a kingdom of priests should be doing. So let's go back to verse 7 of 2 Chronicles 17. Pick up there. And also in the third year of his reign, he sent his princes even to Ben-Hail, and to Obadiah, and to Zechariah, and to Nathanael, to Micaiah, to teach in the cities of Judah. And so, to teach is the word lamad. And it's interesting because it means to goad, or to instruct, to prod, to use a goad, to implore by education. And so you can imagine a big beast of some sort being prodded along and guided in the right direction. Well, this is kind of the idea that we have here with this word teach. These brethren were being taught, goaded along, instructed by education as how they should live and who they should give glory and honor to. And so he sent forth his five specific princes to teach in the cities of Judah. And he begins an all-pervasive, all-embracing campaign of education among the people as the seed of Abraham, as this ecclesia of Yahweh, as we said. And he tries to reach every member of this ecclesia. And of course, this is the commandment that was given back in Deuteronomy 16, verse 18, how the king was supposed to appoint judges to help rule in the lands. And so in the 8th verse, it's listed for us the 9 Levites and the 2 priests who then taught in Judah and had the book of the law of Yahweh with them. Verse 9, and they taught in Judah and had the book of the law of the Lord with them and went about throughout all the cities of Judah and taught the people. So again, we can see this all-pervasive, all-inclusive campaign of education that he sets forth. And they took the word of the Lord with them. Now think of that. It was with them, presented to the people on a daily, ongoing basis for them to absorb, for them to learn from. They went throughout all the cities of Judah and taught the people. And of course, this same word, teach, taught, is what we see here. This goad to instruct or to implore by education. So what was happening in the north at this time? Well, over in the book of Revelation chapter 2, we can get a really good idea of what was taking place. So let's turn over there. Revelation chapter 2, and we're all familiar with this. Speaking to the ecclesia in Thyatira, it seems to describe exactly what's taking place. Remember, the message here to Thyatira was that the Lord commended them in verse 19 for their works, for their love, their faith, their ministry, and their patience. So from this we gather that, yes, there were those who were believers, who were covenanted in Thyatira. But there were people who were serving him in purity. But they also tolerated in their midst a Jezebel class mentioned in verse 20. He says, I know thy works, thy charity, service, faith, patience, works, the last to be more than the first. Notwithstanding, I have a few things against thee, because thou sufferest that woman Jezebel, which calleth herself a prophetess, to teach and to seduce my servants, to commit fornication and to eat things sacrificed unto idols. So this gives us an idea of what's taking place in Israel at the time of Jehoshaphat's education in Judah. But here we see that the Lord has something very serious against them here in Thyatira. He says, because you permit, this is what the word sufferest means, you permit or you let that woman Jezebel, which calls herself a teacher, which is what the word prophetess means, to teach and seduce my servants, he says, to commit fornication and to eat things sacrificed unto idol, Baal. So we see from this verse, brethren, there are three sects of people here, don't we? There are three different groups mentioned here in Revelation 2. We have those who were the eldership or the managing brethren of this ecclesia. those who were the Jezebel group who were teaching this false doctrine, and then those who were being taught or those who were being led astray. What was going on in Thyatira is that this group of people, which we refer to as the Jezebel class, were teaching and seducing the members of the ecclesia who had been, and many were still basically sound and dedicated, but they were teaching them to break down their standards and to commit spiritual fornication. In other words, to give their true and undying love and dedication to something else. It was being allowed to continue by the elders of this ecclesia. These were the ones that were responsible for this divulgence. They should have separated from her, and then not to have to hear the words, as we see here, "I have somewhat against them," if they would have put their foot down, so to speak. Jezebel didn't have it all her way in Israel for quite some time, but slowly it took hold from within, slowly. And so Jehoshaphat was dealing with a kingdom in the north that wasn't all bad, but there were still some in it that were good, and Yahweh knew that. But Jehoshaphat was greatly blessed for strengthening himself against Israel, even though there may have been some there who had not bowed the knee to Baal. So let's ask ourselves a question then, brethren, referring back to Revelation 2. Which would be worse? Literal, physical adultery, or spiritual adultery or fornication? Well, as a type of marriage, we understand the analogy, don't we? Yahweh gave the dowry, that is, His only begotten Son. We are bought with the blood of Christ, aren't we? The ecclesia as the bride then being purchased. And if there is any fornication or adultery or another gospel introduced, then the marriage contract is now compromised. And how do we take on the marriage contract? Of course, in the waters of baptism. Remember, Joseph was within his right to put Mary away because of the unfaithfulness that he thought had taken place. But the angel of the Lord had stepped in. Jezebel taught literal fornication as part and parcel of Baal worship. We would never think that this would be acceptable in any sense. But brethren, sometimes spiritual fornication or adultery is not so easily dismissed. As a matter of fact, sometimes a blind eye is turned in order to preserve so-called peace and relationships. And think, brethren, how betrayed our Master would feel. Spiritual adultery is breaking down the standards, bringing the world into the ecclesia, or taking members of our ecclesia out into the world without a second thought, and going back and forth, as well as consorting with the world in both their moral practices and especially their religious views, doctrines, and lifestyles. It's been said, well, do they really believe that differently than us? This, brothers and sisters, is adultery in the sight of Yahweh. And this is what was being taught in Israel at this time. And so, back in 2 Chronicles 17, we see the great heights that Jehoshaphat had reached in opposition to this false doctrine that was taking place, strengthening himself, as we read. And he understood the difference in what was pleasing to God and what was pleasing to man. He knew the difference in what would come easy and what would be hard to achieve. Early in his life, he was strong. But like his father, as we continue through this account, we see that he grows weaker and less willing to fight the good fight. He gave in to his own self-reliance, as his father did, and he abandoned what he had spent so much effort on establishing early on in Judah. And we'll come to that in a moment. But here in this third year of his reign, he set out educating the people. And remember, Ahab had been reigning in Israel for over 6 years now at one point. Jehoshaphat sets out to do this work. These five princes, these nine Levites, and these two priests. And these all with names which included these divine titles. Isn't that interesting to think about? Names like Ben-Hail, son of might, it means. Obadiah, meaning serving Yahweh. Zechariah, meaning Yahweh hath remembered, and so on. So these men of faith were set out as educators of the people. And these names, with something to do with the divine name or titles involved in the names of these men. It's interesting, though, to really consider the numbers here. We can really get into numbers. We know the significance of numbers in Scripture. The numbers of these set out a particular point to us. We think of these five princes, and five being the number of grace or mercy is established first. We have nine Levites, and the nine is the number of judgment or justice. So we have mercy, and then we have justice or truth. And then we have the number two, these two priests, and two is the number of division or separation. So putting those together, let's look at the importance and the significance as we continue through the account. While Jezebel in the north was teaching God's people to commit fornication and to eat things sacrificed to idols, Jehoshaphat was teaching his ecclesia God manifestation. The manifestation of God's mercy, of His truth, and how this will separate you from the things of the world. This is what was being taught. Of course, separation is the very substrata of God manifestation. We can't display manifestation of God and His ways where there is no separation from the world or from false teachings and doctrines, which are another gospel. There were five princes, nine Levites, and two priests. And in these numbers, we have this indication of what they were teaching in Judah at this time in comparison to what was taking place in Israel. And they go forth carrying the book of the law. And so we look at verse 10 where it says, "And the fear of the Lord fell upon all the kingdoms of the lands that were round about Judah, so that they made no war against Jehoshaphat." Now we know, brethren, that this was not just by chance. God gave them the opportunity now, didn't He? Because of the policies that were being implemented, He gave them the opportunity to teach and to personally fortify themselves, in order to be prepared to contend for their faith. Isn't this the same lesson for us? We have to personally fortify ourselves by education in order to prepare ourselves to contend for the faith. He gave them peace so the job of education could be done, and it was done on the principles of Proverbs 16, verse 7. This says, "When a man's ways please the Lord, he make even his enemies to be at peace with him." And so in this period of Jehoshaphat's life, he diligently applied himself. And in verse 11, we see that even some of the Philistines and the Arabians gave him enormous quantities of animals and presents. This kind of reminds us of Solomon as well, doesn't it? Then in verse 12, "And Jehoshaphat waxed great exceedingly, and he built in Judah castles and cities of store, and he had much business in the cities of Judah, and the men of war, mighty men of valor, were in Jerusalem." And so let's look at this phrase, "waxed great exceedingly." There's something we can learn here as well. Because again, it's bringing home the theme of this chapter, to ascend. Jehoshaphat goes up. He rises up and he soars. So we see the word "wax" then is from this this word "halak," meaning to walk. Then of course the word "great," meaning great or large. And then the word "exceedingly," from the word "ma'el." Again, that word "al," meaning upward or above or overhead. And so here we have a phrase that tells us the direction of Jehoshaphat at this time. This is the path that he was taking here. And this is the faith that we must strive for as well. To wax great exceedingly. We need to be walking greatly upwards, as the meanings bring out, towards our God. And this was the way that Jehoshaphat was going. So verse 13 says that they had the cities of store, and he had much business in the city. So we see that we gain that he was a very hands-on king, we might say, leading his people. And the men of war, the mighty men of valor, were there in Jerusalem. Well, then, continuing on in verses 14 through 18, we see we have these men listed here among the correct characteristics of what they possessed here. We see that next to him, well, there was these of Judah, the captains of thousands. There was Adna, the chief, and with him mighty men of valor, 300,000. Next to him was Jehonan, the captain, and with him 280,000. And next to him was Amasiah, the son of Zichri, who willingly offered himself unto the Lord, and with him 200,000 mighty men of valor. And of Benjamin, Eliada, a mighty man of war, and with him armed men with bow and shield, 200,000. And next to him was Jehozabad, and with him 180,000, ready prepared for the war. So look at these names again. We have some interesting names that kind of portray to us who these men, who Jehoshaphat had the foresight and knowledge and understanding to place in the forefront of the people of Judah. This name Adna means pleasure. Think of how it must have been a pleasure to serve under him. He was found pleasurable in the sight of Yahweh. Johanan, meaning Yahweh hath favored. He favored him with responsibility, and he gave him 280,000 men to look after, all warriors of the faith, we might say. Amasiah, and this man is interesting. We see this word means, or name means, Yah hath loaded. Yah hath loaded. Why did Yahweh load this man with this kind of responsibility? He was the son of Zichri, and Zichri means memorable, and this was a memorable family. We see in 2 Chronicles 23:1, another son of Zichri mentioned there, and he was another faithful man. But here, Amasiah is said to have willingly offered himself unto the Lord, unto Yahweh, in verse 16. And this is the only record that we have where we find Amasiah. But think about this. He was willingly offered. If we could have that summary, brethren, placed at the base of the record of our lives, wouldn't it be the most tremendous thing? Here was a man whom Yahweh had loaded with responsibilities, and he came from a memorable family, and he willingly offered himself unto Yahweh. This name, or this word willingly offered, this word Nadab, to impel, to volunteer spontaneously. Think of how that shows to us. He volunteered all he had, all his service to the truth, spontaneously. He didn't need to be coerced or threatened. He didn't have to be compelled in any other way. He did this spontaneously, out of love and out of obedience, with all of his might. And he offered. This word offered is interesting to look at. The word Zabek, Z-A-B-E-K, to slaughter the sacrifice. And Paul tells us in Romans 12:1 that we ought to offer ourselves as living sacrifices. The same word here, only in Greek, as in 2 Chronicles. So we have Nadab Zabok, and he was the leader of over 200,000 men of valor. And then as we read through, we see Eliada, and his name meant Yah is knowing. So with him, there were over 200,000 men as well. Verse 18, then, we had Jehozabad, Yah hath endowed, and he had been endowed with blessings because of his dedication with faithfulness to God, and with him were 180,000 men. So then it says that they were all ready, prepared for the war. Ready, prepared for the war. These men were armed, prepared, and completely ready for a specific battle. But sadly, brethren, the war that they were about to engage in, they weren't ready for. They weren't prepared. And as we go into the next chapter, we see exactly why they were defeated. You see, it was much more than just a battle for lands and positions. It represented much more. This is the war described at the end of verse 3 of chapter 18. The war against the Syrians in alliance with Ahab. And this is not what they were prepared for. But tragically, it was a war that they had to fight, and it became a disaster for them. So in the 19th verse of chapter 17, we read that they waited on the king beside those whom the king put in the fenced cities throughout all Judah. And so if we've added all these numbers up as we went through, we find that there was 1,160,000 men in the army of Jehoshaphat. 1,160,000. Now that's a lot of men. That's a lot of soldiers. We also notice that that's not all, because it says these waited on the king. These were in Jerusalem. If these were besides those who were in the fenced cities throughout all Judah, then we don't really know how many there were. But we know that there were at least 1,160,000. Jehoshaphat obviously had this massive army at his disposal. And this was the result, as we said, of this policy, this campaign of education. And he brought about this cohesive, united ecclesia in Judah, people who were prepared to stand for the right thing. They were ready, prepared for war. The war against the encroachments of the world, wherever it might have come from. They were ready for it, and they never fought that war, though, because Jehoshaphat changed his policy. So the 17th chapter talks about him rising up and soaring, as we've talked about, walking greatly upwards. But then the 18th chapter is the opposite. We see in the 18th chapter that Jehoshaphat goes down. Verse 1, chapter 18. Now Jehoshaphat had riches and honor in abundance and joined affinity with Ahab. And after certain years, he went down to Ahab to Samaria. Down to Ahab to Samaria. And Ahab killed sheep and oxen for him in abundance for the people that he had with him, and persuaded him to go up with him to Ramoth-Gilead. We've covered so far the reason why Jehoshaphat had riches and honor in abundance, as well as this gigantic army of over 1,160,000. As well, we see why he was blessed at a time of peace, and so he had the opportunity to educate the people, all because of his policy to serve Yahweh. But now we see a huge change in the direction of Jehoshaphat. Verse 2 of chapter 18 says, after certain years, he went down to Ahab, who was recorded as the worst king in the history of Israel. Why did this happen? Why would he have made this alliance? What would have made Jehoshaphat make such a drastic change in judgment? We just read what a wonderful leader he was. Well, there's lots of speculation and ideas, but part of the reason that we could see is that it's found there in verse 1, possibly, which we just read. He had riches and honor in abundance. We know, brothers and sisters, what that can do to the mind of a man. So we can explain the motive as to why he joined this affinity, and then we can talk about that. But we see the riches and honor in abundance may have been a big part of this problem. And it created in him a spirit of self-reliance. His father Asa's problem developed later in his life because of his own weaknesses and ill-preparedness to face the threat of Baasha in the north. But Jehoshaphat's self-reliance sprang out of his own strength. He wasn't weak in any sense. He was strong. And so that strength was so great, he even had this 1,160,000 man army. He had so much, maybe he didn't know what to do with them. But he felt that he was in need of nothing at this point. He was strong. There was no question about his strength. And it was because he was strong that he changed his policy. Instead of strengthening himself against Israel now, continuing on as the years went by, he decided now to try to save them by his strength. You see the difference? He was trying to save them now by the strength that he had. This is what it means when it says he had riches and honor and obedience. Riches meant the wealth that came to him from the gifts that were offered by his people and the nations round about. It poured into Judah. This accumulation of wealth was enormous. But when we speak of this in our terms, as to what it means for us, we know in a spiritual way of looking at this, it means that he was richly blessed in the things of the truth. In spiritual terms, he was blessed abundantly. But those blessings were given to him by God, and they were all a result of this divine blessing. And so to us, that means that if we press on in the things of the truth, if we press on and continue steadfast, if we soar high in God's Word and go about the task of educating every member of our ecclesias and cause them to walk as God manifestation, then we shall be richly blessed as well. We will be blessed with the successive generations of Christadelphians who would hold fast to the truth. This was the position that Jehoshaphat was in. And it also brought about an enormous reputation, didn't it? He was known to be strong in the truth. He was known to have a great army. And he thought that his strength was sufficient to save his brethren in Israel from their apostasy. He thought that he could do something to change this decline that he saw in every facet of his brethren, from their weakened alliances to their detestable false worship. And so he now decides to make this alliance. Possibly he thought he could restore unity, as in the days of Solomon, which weren't too many generations before. This would be a good motive. But what about chapter 19, verse 2? Where he's spoken to by the prophet Jehu, the son of Hanani. Remember, Hanani was the one who spoke to Asa. Where he comes to him and he says to King Jehoshaphat, "Shouldest thou love the ungodly and love them that hate the Lord? Therefore is wrath upon thee from before the Lord, before Yahweh." So, look at the motivation there. Shouldest thou love the ungodly? Was he driven more by his heart than his head? Help and love are great motives, but good motives are never a replacement for spiritual discernment. Good motives are never a replacement for spiritual discernment. Helping and loving must be based on divine principles with salvation in mind. Jehoshaphat had joined affinity with Ahab. And this word joined affinity in Hebrew is the word chathan, meaning to give away in marriage, normally a daughter. The same as when Solomon had made affinity with Pharaoh in taking his daughter to wife. Jehoshaphat's foolish alliance with Ahab almost kills him. And worse than that, it lays the foundation for a series of events in Judah that almost destroys and extinguishes the royal line of Judah, the royal line of King David. And it all starts with a wedding. I have 5 more minutes, is that where? Okay. Just want to make sure I'm on the right. And so it was in this case that he gave away his son. Now we're in chapter 18. And we see here that Ahab, king of Israel, said unto Jehoshaphat, "Wilt thou go with me to Ramoth-Gilead?" in verse 3. And he answered him and said, "I am as thou art, and my people as thy people. We will be with thee in the war." As we continue on down through this account, we see how this is exactly what took place. We see that to contract affinity by marriage, we understand that it was a practice of those times for kings to form this political alliance, and that's what takes place here. kings would marry or have their children marry into each other's family in order to cement or confirm that alliance by marrying into these families. And we see Jehoram in his name. We see Yahweh raised Jehoram. And this is what we saw in chapter 17, right? But he's marrying the daughter of Ahab and Ahab and Jezebel, that is, Athaliah. Think about this. Her name is Yah hath constrained. Yah hath constrained. And something else for us to consider at this particular point, we get this from Kings and other writings, that Jehoram was about 15 years old when this took place. He was about 15 years old. Do we have any 15-year-old boys? Imagine being given in marriage at the age of 15. And not only that, but Jezebel is your mother-in-law. This poor boy didn't have a chance, did he? And so, we see that she was technically, Athaliah was technically from the Samarian ecclesia, right? We're talking about those within the boundaries of Israel. So she was technically from the Samarian ecclesia, but she was definitely not of the proper mindset. And so this became the fate of Jehoram. Let's look over in 1 Chronicles 21, verse 6. 1 Chronicles 21, verse 6. Speaking of Jehoram, he says, "And he walked in the ways of the king of Israel, like as did the house of Ahab, for he had the daughter of Ahab to wife, and he wrought that which was evil in the eyes of the Lord." So sadly, we see what takes place with Jehoshaphat's son, all because of this union, this affinity that he made with Ahab. Yah hath constrained is now the subject of chapter 18. This is probably a good place for me to stop, so we could probably stop here for a minute. I'll rest my voice for a little while, and then we'll take back up. So...